Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. And if it's Friday, it's Scott Braddock, the editor of The Quam Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And lucky for us, we have Scott Braddock, but Scott Braddock also went somewhere else. He checked out Iowa for the Iowa caucus. So not only do we get knowledge of Texas, we get the inside scoop from Iowa, since you had your eyeballs right there. Welcome to the program.
Well, Arnie, it's great to be with you. It's great to be back in Texas after it was just freezing in Iowa. And I'll be with you in New Hampshire next week. So you guys are going to wear out my heavy coats, let me tell you. But I got there over the weekend before this disaster, this meltdown. I visited with our good friend, Dr. Stefan Schmitz, out at Iowa State. I said, because I'm trying to figure this out. And nobody on the ground could tell me, how is this supposed to work, the way that the Democrats had changed the rules for the way that the Iowa caucus was going to happen?
Right.
So I said to him, I said to Stefan, I said, help me understand this. Can you give me the shorthand version and then tell me as much as I need to know, but give me the shorthand version of how this is going to work. And he just sort of looked at me and said, Scott, there's no shorthand version.
Right.
This is going to be a disaster, a complete meltdown.
Oh, my God, and, you're so right.
Absolutely, of course, was. The excitement was, in the air as I landed in Des Moines, and the volunteers were fanning out all across the state. There was a woman who sat next to me on the plane from Austin connecting through St. Louis, and she must have been a socialist because she was a Bernie Sanders supporter, and she brought me a free sandwich.
I tell you. We give you calories.
So anyway, but folks were like going in to volunteer, like strike force type of, activism. Mm-hmm. We're going to get Bernie over the finish line here. Of course, she was from liberal Austin, so she supports Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
But look, it was a meltdown. It was ridiculous.
Right.
As it was playing out, I was driving around as much of the state as I could, ended up back in Des Moines at Mayor Pete's, what turned out to be, victory speech. It's extended into the evening, and as you saw on television, Klobuchar, Sanders, et cetera, sort of declaring their own victories, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're good, mm-hmm. and now we got to go on to New Hampshire, because guess what? Y'all have the primary next week. These candidates don't have time to be hanging around in Iowa,
waiting.
While the Democrats figure their stuff out there, and the state figures out what's going on with the primary, they've got campaigning to do the next day. So they were on the way, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Mayor Pete comes out to the audacity of Pete, right? He's mm-hmm. up there saying, "All indications are we are going to New Hampshire victorious."
Right.
And
right.
people were saying immediately, "Why is he doing that? What if he lost?" Well, what did he have to lose by doing that? I thought this was really smart politics, Arnie. And I compared him to, and some of the folks back here in Texas could appreciate this, and your listeners will appreciate it because we talk about this guy all the time. Our lieutenant governor, Dan Patrick, if he was in that situation, he would do the
same thing.
He would bluff. He would say, "We won," and move on. And what do they have to lose if they don't? You seize the momentum. You're moving from Iowa to New Hampshire, to South Carolina, to Nevada. I mean, the dance is happening now. You don't have time to wait around. So you say, "I won. Move on." And by the way, he didn't know when those results were going to come out. They could have come out a month from now. They could have. They trickled out. And the reporting is this morning that there's a bunch of inconsistencies and errors.
Oh, no,
of course, we're taping here on Thursday, and we'll see what the reporting is by Friday and in the days to come.
Mm-hmm.
But Iowa's about that momentum. You want your ticket out of Iowa. So if there's chaos, embrace the chaos.
First of all, it reminded me of Bill Clinton. When Bill Clinton became the comeback kid in New Hampshire in 1992, Paul Tsongas won the New Hampshire primary. Let me inform people. Bill Clinton did not. He did not. But
comeback
he seized
kid.
The moment. So I want to just explain to you, Mayor Pete is like three other people. Your lieutenant governor, Bill Clinton, and Donald Trump. Those four people would do exactly the same thing. Facts don't matter. Results don't matter. I'm getting the headline. I'm walking out. I don't know if that plays well for Mayor Pete, because if I'm comparing him to Donald Trump, your lieutenant governor, and Bill Clinton, we're all going to sit there and going, okay, is this status quo campaigning going into 2020? And is that what we want? More of the same.
Well, those folks all have something else in common. They all won.
I know. I hear you.
They all win. You know, it's like if they're playing poker, Arnie. If you don't know it, if the cards haven't been turned up, you know, face up yet, you act like you have a royal flush.
I know.
So you just go with it, right?
You know,
there's no penalty for any of that in politics.
Well, the one thing, since you were on the ground there, the one thing that really, really mm-hmm. disappointed me, and I've been saying this over and over again in every venue, and that is we were told that this was going to be the largest turnout ever. It was going to clip 2008. We're going to see people coming in from everywhere. It turned out the numbers were pathetic. They're about the size of 2016. People mm-hmm. didn't show up. So at the same time, it's not only about the cast. Can you imagine if they had huge numbers? I mean, we wouldn't know the results until Christmas of 2021. So in a lot of ways, I am disappointed on every level. An app that was never tested, you know, and then you find out that Donald Trump's supporters found out what the phone number was for the Democratic Party in Iowa and started basically jamming the lines. We don't need to worry about the Russians. We need to worry about Trump. I mean, it's just incredible. So, yeah, my producer said Trump and the Russians are the same thing. So who knows?
People were saying, you know, Vladimir had his way in Iowa. There was some sort of hacking going on. My favorite tweet about all of it was somebody said, because there was this problem with the reporting app that they were using that had been developed. And somebody said, next time just have Tinder. Develop the app. It actually works.
That's hilarious.
But I got to, you know, Arnie, to your point, if any group can, you know, set up a system that confuses everyone, leaves no one satisfied, and
they
puts Trump in position to win a second term, it's the Democratic Party. Now, I will say, and I have this on the list of things to talk about this morning, in Texas, the Texas Democratic Party just came out yesterday and said they had a meeting with the Secretary of State for Texas, which, by the way, the Texas Secretary of State over the last year and a half has, you know, inspired so much confidence. You remember the purge of voters that we talked about in the last year mm-hmm. that turned out to be totally bogus. Mm-hmm. It looked like they were, you know, attempting to erase people with Hispanic surnames from mm-hmm. The voter registration rolls in Texas. The Democratic Party said yesterday that they met with the Texas Secretary of State, and the agency said that they would not be able to ensure timely results in Texas, in the primary, coming up in just a few weeks. And, you know, we have huge excitement here. And one of the parallels, Arnie, by the way, all this, just people being jazzed up, but maybe not turning out in large numbers. In Fort Bend County, that special election for a Texas House seat that we talked about a couple weeks ago, after Democrats were just destroyed in that race, lost it by 16 points to the Republican, after Bloomberg, Warren, Beto, Castro, Biden, all got involved trying to help the Democrat in that race. But even afterwards, Democrats seemed upbeat. They really seemed upbeat. And I'm not sure what the national coverage, I didn't watch all of it, but I can tell you what I saw on the ground. A lot of times, Arnie, when I'm reporting on something firsthand, I avoid watching a lot of the national coverage of something because I don't want to adopt their assumptions about what's going on.
Right.
What I saw firsthand in Iowa was a lot of Democrats who, even though things were melting down, and we could all see that, but people were still pretty upbeat. So, you know, I mean, hope is not a strategy,
but I see
there's something in the air that the Democrats are, the ones who are showing up, are very enthused, and I don't know where that's going to make the difference. I think that in these races where, especially back here in Texas, some of these suburban districts we've talked about, that sort of enthusiasm, I think, is going to contribute to having races that are basically coin flips in November. You know, we'll just figure out at the very end, you know, whether these races come down to 1 point or 2 points and, you know, just how competitive the Democrats can be back here at home.
Well, let me just say something, because you were mentioning that they had a meeting with the Secretary of State of Texas. So let's talk about this meeting, because that's another concern here, is that Texas is going to be very important. There is going to be a primary vote for 2020 in Texas.
Yep.
So what did they get told by the Texas Secretary of State? I don't think it was good news. And how can they rehabilitate the relationship?
No, it wasn't good news. Basically, they were telling them that based on what we're looking at as far as potential turnout in the March 3rd primary, that it's going to be very difficult to get quick results.
Why?
Back into the state. Now there's something to that. I can tell you that
the
top counties. I'm sorry.
I want you to tell me why. They've done this before, so I want to know why it's difficult this time.
It's certainly difficult. You may remember that because Texas is, and it's not that they do them quickly, by the way, and have always done them quickly. There are 254 counties in Texas, mm-hmm. and that is a challenge. The most populous counties, the 13 to 14 to 15 or so most populous counties where most of the people in the state live, they'll report fairly quickly. Right. In Harris County, which is where Houston is, we have a history of the results taking forever in some of these elections. Mm-hmm. And by forever, I mean until 2 a.m. or so, right. Sometimes the next day. And that has been improving since a change in leadership there in Harris County. So we'll see. But for the rest of those counties, it'll be interesting to see what kind of folks turn out in rural Texas for a Democratic primary. Right. Those are generally Republican areas, but that doesn't mean that there aren't some Democrats who live out in the hinterlands, you know, right. and Lubbock and far west Texas and mm-hmm. you know, down in the valley, of course, is very Democratic and rural through a lot of that. And so we'll see. By the way, I did want to say, I thought it was an interesting argument made by quite a few people on social media and I think in some op-eds, this drive to have immediate election results. I mean, I'm in the news business. I want to have them as quickly as anybody. But that is driven by cable news. That is driven by the candidates also wanting to be able to give their speeches in reaction to right. to what the results are. But that doesn't have anything to do with whether the results come back accurate. Arnie, I'd rather they come out with the results in a week from Iowa mm-hmm. and have them be right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and then we can report on it. I get that everybody wants to have the stuff quickly, but there is a natural tension between, you know, trying to get it right versus trying to get it out as fast as you can. And that's part of why we saw the meltdown there in Iowa.
But Scott, we're living in social media. It's instant gratification. It's a whirling dervish. We don't.
Sure.
It's like Amazon. I can deliver to you in
sure.
2 hours. I'm like, who cares? I mean, I can't even get to the store in 2 hours. Like, is it this? But that is what is happening. We have speeded everything up. So here's my question to you about the results in Texas. And that is, you mentioned the rural areas. You mentioned the urban areas. So tell me about the Hispanic vote. We know that we've been hearing over and over again that there's been a real sort of push to bring it out from the shadows, to make sure it participates, to encourage them to do it. Mm-hmm. So have you really seen a rise or a spike in engagement? And do you think there will be a result that will represent that sort of Latino vote?
It's a difficult thing to tell. You know, the way that we try to gauge the Hispanic engagement in elections in Texas has always been to look at the voter rolls and go based off of Hispanic surnames. And in the 2018 U.S. Senate race, because it had so much national attention and was the most expensive Senate race in United States history between Cruz and O'Rourke, we actually had exit polling out of that race, which we don't ever get exit polling in Texas, Arnie. We love it when we do. And I hope we do. I guess we will on this primary that's coming up. We'll see. But in the exit polling, what it showed was that there was a surge, a big spike, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but a big spike in Hispanic voting in that election in 2018. I can tell you, and we've talked about this previously, that in the 2017 legislature in Texas, there were two more divisive bills than this, but two divisive bills that people remember. One of them was the bathroom bill in 2017,
yes,
pushed by the Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, which failed to pass thanks to the leadership of the then Speaker Joe Strauss, who said the business community
who let the message out that this is not helpful.
Right. And then the other bill that did pass and that Governor Abbott signed into law is a ban on so-called sanctuary cities. This includes language that says that peace officers around the state can inquire about your immigration status, can basically ask you for your papers. It's the Arizona-style show me your papers bill. We have that in Texas now. It's been the law since 2017. And guess what? There are a few people who have turned 18 years old since then, and a lot of them are Hispanic. And they will tell you, and this is anecdotal, but I've seen it everywhere I've traveled in this state, whether it was in Houston or Dallas or Fort Worth or in the Valley or in the Panhandle or far west Texas, going all the way out to El Paso. Young Hispanics who are involved in politics now, whether they're working on campaigns or they're working in a legislative office or they're just volunteering, or suddenly they're telling you, I am going to vote. They will say the reason that they're involved in politics is that bill.
That bill.
They cannot believe that that happened. And it didn't happen under Governor Perry when he was there. It didn't happen under Governor Bush when he was there. Go all the way back to when Governor Bush was there, and what a different sort of Republican Party we have in this state. There was a time, Arnie, when immigration and border security was not an issue in politics in this state. I mean, you can go back pre-2006, and it wasn't a huge deal. It was in 2006 that Governor Perry started to incorporate it into his campaigns, and he would talk about how in his TV commercials, he would talk about the idea that if Washington wants to secure this border, Texas will. This was sort of the nascent Tea Party.
Wasn't he threatening to leave the union? I thought he threatened to leave the union over it.
Not over that. But, not over that, but he did say some things about secession. Reason to dissolve. He said, we have a good union. There's no reason to dissolve it. which, of course, people then wonder why you would say it in the first place.
Exactly.
That's a flash forward to 2010. This has been growing. This anti-immigrant sentiment has been growing. And by the way, before immigration and border security became such a big issue for Republicans, if you go back and look at the vote totals, election cycle after election cycle, the share of Hispanics voting for Republicans was going up and up and up. These are folks who aren't necessarily liberal. All polling shows that, everything I've seen, shows that Hispanics break down just about like the population at large. They're not monolithic in any way, shape, or form.
Until you put a target on their back.
Until you say, we're going to kick your grandma out of Houston.
Exactly.
In Texas and in other places around the country, if you have a Hispanic family, there is probably at least one or two people who live in the home who are not documented, and other people in the home are documented. And so that has changed the dynamic. It has, serious repercussions. It did in 2018 when Beto didn't win. But as we've talked about, there were 12 new Democrats in the Texas House, 2 new Democrats in the Texas Senate, and 2 congressional districts, one in Dallas and one in Houston, flipped from Republican to Democratic. And I think Republicans do have a shot at taking some of those seats back. I don't think either of those congressional seats they can get, but we'll see. They have to do it now, right, while these sort of frontline Democrats are freshmen. If they don't get them while they're freshmen, if they don't get them out of there then they become ensconced, and it's harder to get them out. But look, there's going to be a huge battle in this state for the Hispanic vote, and Republicans have done everything they can in the last 3 or 4 years
to try to alienate
those folks.
And Donald Trump helped them in his State of the Union address. I mean, can't believe we aren't think about what we aren't talking about. We're not talking about the State of the Union. We're not talking about the impeachment vote. It's just that there's such a cacophony of stuff happening at the same time, all of it, which is cataclysmic when you think about it, and yet there isn't time to even deal with it. But I want to go back to just one more thing. So who runs the primary in Texas? Is it run out of the Secretary of State's office, or do the parties run the primaries?
The parties run the primary, but the Texas Secretary of State is there to count the votes. So we'll see how this goes.
It's going to be so interesting.
And technically there are 2 primaries, right? I mean, and everything happens at once. You have the you have all of the state level races that are happening at the same time. Which I learned that's not the case in Iowa. I guess
no, it's not the case in New Hampshire either. It's not the case here.
Yeah. Interesting. In Texas, it all happens at once. So it'll be the presidential candidates as well as everybody who's running for state Senate, state House, and on down the ballot.
So what's the coattail effect of that?
So it's a huge task to get all that done.
So what's the coattail effect of that? So in New Hampshire, just like Iowa, we have the primary, the caucus, in January, February. But then for us, we don't even have our primary for state offices until September. So in a lot of ways, they're so separated. But given what you're seeing now with the level of enthusiasm now, and I don't know who's polling well when it comes to the 2020 candidates on the Democratic side, how will that influence who wins down ballot?
Hard to say. What I'll be interested to see is what the level of enthusiasm for the Republican primary is, because we do have some races that are going to be interesting in various communities around the state. But this year, all the action seems to be in the Democratic primary because you have the presidential, of course. That just so overshadows everything else. I'm thinking all the way back to 2008 when Clinton and Obama were still battling it out for the nomination. And you may remember Texas, by the time the Texas primary rolled around, John McCain had already, sewn it up. He was going to be the Republican nominee, and there wasn't a lot of action on the Republican side. And 3 million people voted in the Democratic primary, which at the time was a huge number.
Right.
And a lot of Republicans crossed over to vote in the Democratic primary because there was excitement about who the Democratic nominee was. And you might remember Medal of Freedom honoree Rush Limbaugh at the time, back in 08, was encouraging Texas Republicans to vote in the Democratic primary to further cause chaos within the Democratic primary, which who knows if they'll do that again. They actually called it Operation Chaos at the time. By the way, so, sort of interesting bank shot. There are people who are Republicans running for office now as Republicans who are having to answer the question about why they voted in the Democratic primary in 2008. They're like, well, don't you remember? Rush was telling us to do that.
Exactly.
No one even remembers or cares about that. But if you ever voted in the primary of the other party, that's totally disqualifying if you're running for Texas.
Okay, so I want to move into Bloomberg for this reason. So last night I get a phone call from Stefan Schmidt, and Stefan's watching television in Iowa, everyone. He lives in Nevada, Iowa. And he calls me up and he goes, I just saw a Bloomberg ad. It was all Obama. Obama introducing him here, Obama introducing him there. He said, and I remember, this is in Iowa. So Iowa's caucus has just ended like 48 hours before, sort of ended. And already Bloomberg is in there. But the first ad he airs in Iowa is him like playing Kumbaya with Barack Obama.
Right.
And so here's the first question we had. And that is that, do you have to get permission from Barack Obama to use him in an advertisement? I believe Elizabeth Warren has used him, but this was incredible. And the difference between what Bloomberg was able to do with Barack Obama versus what Elizabeth Warren was able to do is that he's able to do it in 50 states at the same time.
That's
Nobody
right.
understands that this isn't an endorsement. All they do is see them together. Do you know who that screwed? He just screwed Joe Biden. Completely buried Joe Biden. And to have it happen literally within hours after the Iowa caucus, I mean, Stefan was floored. He almost fell off his chair. And again, his first impression, now he is a political science professor for 50 years. His first impression was that it was an endorsement by Barack Obama. And then he stepped back and breathed and realized, no. They happened to be in the same room together and they were saying nice things about each other. But if his reaction was endorse, then guess what? The rest of us are going to make the same assumption. Joe Biden must be dying.
Yeah, and his poor performance there in Iowa, just, somebody was talking about how on Tuesday morning when the results were still not in, people were talking about how Joe Biden, how many times has he run, and he still hasn't won a caucus or primary.
No. And here's what I said. Well, I was talking to the Washington Post reporter yesterday, and I was saying to her, I said, here's the problem with Joe Biden. We all like him. He's a nice guy. He's very familiar to us. I said, so this is how I described it. I said, he's familiar, and he's comfortable like my slippers. I said, the problem is when I go out for a hike, I can't wear my slippers. I got to put on my boots. And that's the problem. What he's showing you is he can't take it to the people. He can't accomplish the task. If he can't accomplish it in Iowa and comes in fourth, if he comes in, and he may come in third or fourth, if not fourth for sure, I think, in New Hampshire, how does South Carolina say we still want him? I understand that the black vote feels very comfortable with him, but you know what? They don't want comfort. They need a win. And now the problem is, where do they go with their vote?
Yeah, and the Buttigieg folks were making the case that even though he hasn't, caught fire with the African-American voters out there, there was a black activist who brought Buttigieg on stage in Iowa who runs a community center in South Bend. This woman does. She was very charming.
Mm-hmm.
She said, they're talking about, I'm paraphrasing, but she said, they're all talking about how the black folks don't like Mayor Pete. Well, I'm black as can be, and I love him, and blacks in South Bend love him. And they brought him out. It was it was quite a welcome, and speaks to your point, which is folks are going to now try to figure out where those voters are going to go. They want the win, like you say.
So I the other thing that I think it's also important, and this is for you to pay attention to. So in New Hampshire, the biggest group is the undeclareds. They represent about 40% of the electorate. Okay, they're bigger than Republicans or Democrats. They really have no incentive to go to the Republican ticket. I mean, Donald Trump's Bill Weld never really ran a campaign, who cares? So they're going to look on the Democratic side, or they're going to do something else. They're going to pick up their pencil and they could write someone in. I told everyone, pay attention to the write-ins for Michael Bloomberg.
Mm-hmm.
Because while Michael Bloomberg isn't running in New Hampshire, it is Super Tuesday that happens right after us, or like right after South Carolina and Nevada. It comes up pretty quick. Who are Super Tuesday states? Massachusetts and Vermont. Where are his ads running? In Massachusetts and Vermont. Who gets to see Bloomberg ads in New Hampshire?
Duh. Y'all sure do.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. So it is going to be interesting. And now as Joe Biden is failing, people are nervous. You know, can we elect an openly gay president? And that really is the question for us. And the reason I say this, and nobody has talked about this. Remember when I think it was a Hallmark station or one of those like mushy stations where there was an advertisement on that station. And in the advertisement was a gay couple like holding hands or doing something. Yeah. They made them take the commercial off. They made them take the commercial off. Now the question is, do we have the capacity to get beyond that prejudice and vote him as president? This is really the $64,000 question. He's smart. He's articulate. He packages. I described him as the moderate that was made in a Petri dish. I mean, he's perfect in that way. The problem is that, you know, this is a big challenge, not just for the evangelical base.
Yeah.
It's a big challenge for other people as well.
Our mayor in Austin, Steve Adler, has been out there as a surrogate for Mayor Pete, and my suggestion has been that Mayor Pete needs to run for Austin City Council. We could use a moderate or two at Austin City Hall. One other thing, I know you're running out of time, Arnie, on Bloomberg. Keep this in mind. You're talking about how he's running ads in all the different states.
Yeah.
You know, he's up on the air everywhere. They're buying all this Facebook advertising and everything else. Mike Bloomberg, we know about his wealth because, you know, his business is publicly traded, and you look at everything as real numbers, right? He could spend $2 billion, and you know how long it would take him to earn it back?
Oh, seconds. I mean,
I'm for real here.
No,
5 years.
Five years. Okay, so $2 billion he could earn back in 5 years.
That's a real number.
Wait. But if Donald Trump wins again, he'll have another tax cut, and then guess what? He'll do it in a year. And on that note, I love you. I can't wait to see you, Scott Braddock, editor of the Quorum Report, voice of Texas. He'll be joining me in New Hampshire on Monday. I can't stand it. I'm so excited. Anyway, thank you so much, and just be safe.
See you soon, Arnie.
All right,
ciao.
Bye-bye. All right, everyone, stick around. Now we're going to Iowa.
Going with the Flow on today's Current Cast. With water shortages plaguing much of the U.S., we must use less to flush, brush, and wash, but we still want our water fixtures to work well. The U.S. government created the WaterSense label so consumers and contractors can easily choose products certified not only for minimal water use, but also for peak performance. And WaterSense certified toilets, faucets, spigots, shower heads, and the like are not hard to find.
Right now, there's more than 12,000 products that meet the label specification.
That's Karen Wirth of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. She says WaterSense certified products save water, energy, and money. A win for your wallet and the world. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
You walk into the room with your pencil in your hand. See somebody naked and you say, who is that man? You try so hard, but you don't understand just what you will say when you get home. Because something is happening here, but you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones? You raise up your head and you ask, is this where it is? Then somebody points to you and says, it's his. And you say, what's mine? And somebody else says, well, what is? And you say, oh my God, am I here all alone? But something is happening and you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones? You hand in your ticket and you go watch the geek. who immediately walks up to you when he hears you speak and says, how does it feel to be such a freak? And you say, impossible, as he hands you a bone. And something is happening here, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? You have many contacts among the lumberjacks to get you facts when someone attacks your imagination. But nobody has any respect anyway. They already expect you to all give a check to tax-deductible charity organizations. Ah, you've been with the professors and they've all liked your looks. With great lawyers you have discussed lepers and crooks. You've been through all of F. Scott Fitzgerald's books. You're very well read, it's well known. But something is happening here and you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? Sword swallower, he comes up to you and then he kneels. He crosses himself and then he clicks his high heels. And without further notice, he asks you how it feels. And he says, here is your throat back, thanks for the loan. And you know something is happening, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? Now you see this one-eyed midget shouting the word now, and you say, for what reason? And he says, how? And you say, what does this mean? And he screams back, you're a cow. Give me some milk or else go home. And you know something's happening, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? Walk into the room like a camel and then you frown. You put your eyes in your pocket and your nose on the ground. There ought to be a law against you coming around. You should be made to wear earphones, 'cause something is happening and you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones?
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott. Well, we had to go to Iowa. We had no choice. The numbers are still rolling in, although I think it might be Bernie by a hair, but I'm not sure. We taped this on Thursday morning, so by Friday, maybe you will know the results. Not that the results at this point really matter, because everybody's claiming victory or they're at least building on the chaos. So I decided I needed to reach out to Sean Sebastian. He is the movement politics organizer for Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement Action Fund. We have had him join us a number of times on the air. He's incredibly articulate, very well sort of steeped in Iowa politics and national politics. But before we grab Sean, I did want to at least say something positive about the Iowa caucus before I trash it. And that is that it was a tweet by Aaron Morey, M-O-R-A-Y. And Aaron wrote the following. In the last three Democratic primaries, the top vote getters in Iowa were a black man, a woman, a socialist Jew, a gay man. If that's not historic, I don't know what is. And that's a real compliment to Iowa. And it also just says, just because someone is black, don't make an assumption. Just because someone is white, don't make an assumption. Just because someone is rural, don't make an assumption. Again, I think it's about the fact that people are informed, they care, they're passionate, they're making a decision that they think is not only good for their lives, but good for their country. That's my compliment to Iowa. That's my compliment to New Hampshire. But Sean Sebastian, I don't know whether we should still have the First in the Nation primary or the First in the Nation caucus. But more importantly, share what the hell happened. And also, my first question, Sean, which is my greatest disappointment, the frickin' turnout. Everyone said it was going to be the biggest turnout. It was going to eclipse 2008 when Barack Obama ran. And I'm looking at the numbers, and the numbers are about the same as 2016. And my level of disappointment is it should have been double what 2008 was, because look at who we are so afraid of. We are afraid of Donald Trump. And if that didn't drive people into the caucus, I don't know what the hell would do it.
Yeah, you know, that was really disappointing. And, you know, I guess just one thing to say at the top, you know, like the middle of the chaos, actually most were in terms of the results, like this was the most smoothly run, and I think with the new data, accurate caucus that we've ever had. When it comes to all the volunteers, all the work to get the results in each of the caucuses, that all went well. I'll just say that on the ground, in terms of getting the results in each of the caucuses, this was the best run, most accurate caucus that probably ever been. And then once all of us who were on the ground collecting those results tried to report them, that's when the disaster started with the Iowa Democratic Party. So I think that's important to note, that now we have more data than we've ever had. We have the actual popular vote count totals for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Counts like people had better training, things went smoother. There's a lot of reports from across the state that this was the best caucus that a lot of old-time caucus goers have seen. The breakdown was in the breakdown of communication between those results and the state party, and the kind of continuing fiasco in the rollout of the results.
Okay, so talk to me about what happened. So what we've been hearing is like fools, the Iowa Democratic Party posted the call-in number where people could call in their results. And then what happened was, you know, a bunch of Trump supporters saw that number and they decided they were going to clog the line. Therefore, people were on hold for 2 hours. You were on hold for 2 hours. I think you became, you know, internationally famous for how long you were on hold for. So tell me about how this thing was thought out and why anybody in their right mind would publicly, you know, produce the number to call in, knowing that only a discrete number of people should ever have that number, because once it gets out, anybody could do what the Trump supporters did.
You know, look, there's a million different things that can go wrong in a system that is as unnecessarily complicated as a caucus process, right? So like, the hotline number, got it from, because it was printed in a caucus guide that I got as a caucus secretary for my precinct. Now, remember, there are 1,700 precincts across Iowa. That means 1,700 different people across Iowa
have that number,
getting that information, and, you know, maybe not being thinking about the idea that, like, oh, if I, you know, take a picture of this, there's a number here and someone might see it who has bad intent. You know, like, these are all volunteer run, right? You know, like, I didn't want to be a caucus secretary. My neighbor just roped me into it, right? Like, this is a lot of work. I spent, you know, I got to my elementary school at 4:30 in the afternoon, and I was on the phone until 11:30 p.m. Like, and all unpaid, right? Like, that's happening 1,700 times across the state because of the ridiculousness of this caucus process. So, you know, these types of problems are going to be inevitable. I think the failure is really in not preparing kind of fail-safe mechanisms, right? Like, I went into the caucus knowing that the app wasn't working. So I was planning to use the hotline from the very beginning.
Okay.
And, like, yeah, maybe there was a way to, you know, like, that a bunch of other people were who got the wrong number, or, you know, got the number and were flooding it, et cetera, should have been fail-safe mechanisms, right? Like, they all had our phone numbers, right? They could have sent us, the precinct secretaries, a text with a number to call in.
Exactly,
or something, right?
Exactly.
Like, you know, I'm not an expert on that, but, like, they had 4 years to think about it. There's no excuse for this kind of breakdown, even if there were people from outside trying to sabotage
it. Okay, so there's a couple of things I want to check off. So obviously, I'm still disappointed about the turnout. You said this was, you know, an incredibly well-run caucus until you had to report the numbers to the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
But it might have been a well-run caucus. But tell me about turnout. What happened with turnout? That's my first question. Tell me about these satellite caucus sites, because I'm trying to get my wrap my head around that, because that's what we're waiting for now, and that's what's changing the numbers between Mayor Pete and Bernie Sanders. And then finally, what I also am trying to figure out is tell me about this weighted voting. It feels so much like the Electoral College that I hate. Why are certain communities weighted more than others, and who made that up?
Yeah, so this is the other thing about the Iowa caucuses. Like, let's just put it in context, right? Like, New Hampshire has the first primary. So, but Iowa wants to be first in the nation and get all the attention and all the media and all the money that comes with that. So in order to stay first in the nation, we just can't be a primary. So we have to use this antiquated, right, difficult to administer system of the caucuses.
Right.
And any kind of step towards ease of administration and more accessibility and, you know, a paper trail is a step closer to a primary, which then threatens our first in the nation status. So the first thing to understand is that there is no democratic value to having a caucus system. There's nothing that is better about it than a ranked choice primary.
Exactly. Like, ranked choice primary is what I was thinking about the whole time. I was looking at the caucus where people are going from their first choice to their second choice to their third choice. I'm going, that's ranked choice voting. Why don't you just do that? It's so much more efficient.
It's so much more efficient, right? So, like, all of this, all of these questions about the weighted delegates and all of that, it's a totally fabricated, unnecessary mess. And this is why there's a reform instituted for the first time that we know the raw vote totals. We know what people's first choices were, and we know what the total second choices were. Then it gets processed through this math that is convoluted and unnecessary, and that gives you the state delegate equivalent. Mm-hmm. And then those state delegates ultimately apportion the delegates that go to the national convention.
Right.
Now, where we're at now with 97% of the precincts reporting, the delegates going to the national convention are tied between Buttigieg and Sanders, and Sanders is winning in the popular vote.
Right.
The only way that Buttigieg is winning is with this kind of absurd state delegate equivalent, where you take the raw vote total, run it through a bunch of unnecessary math, and then you get an arbitrary number that means nothing, and that's the only measurement that Pete Buttigieg is winning by. So I can tell you, like, in my caucus, the way this works, you know, like, I believe, Sanders had 111, we had 285 people in our caucus, right?
Okay.
And Sanders had 111 people. And Buttigieg, I think, ended up with like 75 or something like that, something close to that.
Mm-hmm.
So then we run it through the math. You take the total, multiply it by 6, because we have delegates,
okay,
then divide that number by 285,
okay,
and you get a number. And for Sanders, that number was 2.4, and for Buttigieg, that number was 1.5. And, I didn't mention Warren, but Warren, better than Buttigieg, she got like 82 or 83, and she was at 1.8. You round all of those things up to the nearest whole number, Sanders gets 2, Buttigieg gets 2, and Warren gets 2.
Oh, so my God,
though,
so unfair! It's so
Sanders
unfair!
Sanders won by so much, the outcome of my precinct turned out to be a three-way tie.
Oh, see, this is, no one has done this math for me. Thank you so much, Sean Sebastian.
Yeah.
Now I understand why I really hate it. And I really hate it now even more than before.
Well, it's essentially like 1,700 little mini electoral colleges across the state.
It's horrific. All right. So let me also ask you, so tell me about these satellite places. Because the satellites look like, I was seeing numbers. Bernie was blowing it out in so many of the satellite caucuses. Where were these satellite caucuses? What explains Bernie getting huge numbers? In some cases, I think Mayor Pete got none. Where were they located? I want to move there.
Yeah.
But I'm just trying to figure out where were they?
So this is a really important reform of the caucuses, because, you know, like, unlike any other normal, you know, like, voting system, like ranked choice primary, for example, where you could absentee vote, You could early vote. You could vote, you know, like, you know, here we can vote at the public library the
right.
whole week of an election, except for the caucuses, where you have to be physically present at the designated time in order to be counted. Now, what that means is that if you're a parent with a child mm-hmm. and you can't find a babysitter, you can't participate. If you're disabled and you can't get to your local gymnasium, your local school to participate, you can't participate. If you work, at McDonald's or if you work at the grocery store,
if you,
you
work
can't
at a meatpacking plant because you're working second shift or third shift, you can't go.
Exactly. So one of the reforms, again, we have to keep this convoluted system because we want to
be first,
be a caucus, not a primary, and we want to go first. So one of the reforms, though, which is a positive step, is these satellite caucuses for those people who are working, you know, like the night shift, for the people who have, who English isn't their first language, for the people who are Iowans, registered in Iowa, but maybe they're living at the moment in Washington, D.C. or Paris, France or other places, right? So we create, like, these are normally things that can easily be addressed through absentee voting and also, and early voting, right? But they've created the satellite caucus system, which is an improvement in a broken system. So the satellite caucus system means that, you know, you had some, like, very beautiful, like, there was a satellite caucus, I think the first one of the day, and it was mostly all Ethiopian migrant meatpacking workers.
Wow.
And they unanimously went to Bernie Sanders. I saw from a Spanish language only satellite caucus,
right.
And Bernie Sanders swept all the delegates.
Right.
You know, and you can see why that, like, this measure to kind of be more inclusive of people of color, of working people, of immigrants, you know, it obviously does not go in Pete's favor, right? Like, those are all the constituencies that Pete does most terribly with. And also, I think, like, you're seeing that the Sanders team did some unprecedented and really great organizing of people who don't normally participate
right.
in the caucuses simply because they can't.
Well, and now let me just say something. And now you understand why the Republicans understand voter suppression, and on occasion, a couple of Democrats kind of like it too. Anyway,
yeah.
So as I'm listening to you, and so we're beginning to understand what happened with the numbers. You got to explain something to me. What the H happened to Joe Biden? Did he have no organization? Did he not have a message? I mean, everyone thought that Joe Biden would do well. Historically, the Iowa caucus is not only white, but it's older. That would seem to define the Joe Biden, you know, relationship. They've known him for a long time. He's familiar to them. This would be someone they would be very comfortable with. And yet his numbers tanked. I mean, in a way, he probably valued the chaos coming out of Iowa because it doesn't have to point to a really bad number because we still don't know what that bad number looks like. But I'm telling you, it must have started to fall apart because Mayor Pete already was on the ascendance. And I see him basically eating Joe Biden's hide. And I think that that's going to continue into New Hampshire, where Joe Biden, I don't think, ever really had any significant organization. We're a very libertarian state. We're the first state to embrace gay marriage in the country legislatively. So I see Pete working very well with the sort of well-heeled voter in New Hampshire. I'm just trying to figure out, Joe had an opportunity to at least prove his mettle in Iowa. Was there no campaign there?
Yeah, you know, this is a really great question. I think that, you know, so it, when your whole message is electability, losing an election like this so badly is just
devastating.
You know, it kind of topples the whole house of cards because electability is just, you know, an agreement that we all make that we're afraid that our, you know, top choice will lose. And we think other people like this guy, right?
Right.
So when you look around and other people don't like this guy, it just is really devastating. And I can say, you know, in my caucus and in a lot of caucuses that I've heard reported is like, he just didn't have the support at the beginning, you know, like he didn't meet the 16% viability threshold in a lot of places.
Right.
And those people, you know, in my caucus, even before I could get the first count, like those people bailed. They saw, like, oh my gosh, like there's not many of us here. Let's all just go over to Pete.
So explain to me, though. So the other thing is we're rearranging the deck chairs, okay? That's what we're seeing happen. I thought people had to declare when they first came in who they were with, and that meant that that's where they needed to sort of stay. What happened to that? I mean, so tell me, how do you rearrange? Is it that you don't have to stay unless you get to 15%? But what if you got to 15%? Did you have to stay? Could you stay after 15%? I'm just trying to figure out who gives you the license to move.
I'm not going to dive into these details. Frankly, I do not think they will ever be relevant again.
Okay, thank you. All right, that's fine. All right. I just want everyone to know this is why it looked like it was chaos. It felt that way. Nobody understood what the rules were. We're trying to watch from the outside. We want to maintain the integrity of the results, but at the same time, in a lot of ways, I feel like you were a royal punt, and now everything is on New Hampshire's shoulders because we really got no direction from Iowa, and now what we need to figure out is, what does this mean? And I think both of us are on the same page, and that is, does it make sense, given the changing demographic of this country, for New Hampshire and Iowa to go first? And in an interesting way, I think this may be our last hurrah, both for New Hampshire as well as Iowa. Not that we haven't valued it, Sean, but what we also understand is that what do we value more, going first, or it really reflects the sort of future of our nation? And frankly, I don't think we do this. And I feel like I'm playing a Mitt Romney here. I want to do a profile. I want to do a profile in courage. You know, I'm talking to my God, and my God says, you love New Hampshire going first, but is it good for what's even more important than you? And that's really how I feel. And I feel like that's really the pardon the expression, the come to Jesus moment. I'm an atheist, but I really feel like that's really how it is, that we have to be honest with ourselves, that is this a value to our country?
Yes, exactly. I mean, absolutely, right? So let me, if you want, I'll walk through, you know, your question about the math, and then, like, I absolutely think this should be the last caucus. I think that there's been, like, caucuses are not in a way to measure democracy. I think they're completely undemocratic, and we should abolish them across the board and replace it with ranked choice primaries.
Yes,
so
totally
we have as many people voting as possible, and we have the most accurate results and easiest administration of those results. Like, I think it's a no-brainer. We're a party that values one person, one vote, and democratic participation and representation, and the system as it is just needs to be scrapped, and we need to start over. And I think that these results in Iowa are the best argument for that.
Well, let me just say, you have to do the math, because let me just, I want to continue this conversation, because I think this is too important. Yeah. So let's remind everyone what ranked choice voting is. And let me tell you something else. The reason why I like ranked choice voting, and Sean, I'm a former legislator. I ran for governor. I ran for Congress. So I get the system. I was always the young radical. They used to call me the young Turk. I sat in the back of the house. Everybody knew who I was. I didn't talk very often, but when I did, you came in to listen. Okay, this is how it was. But what I also understood was I didn't think that compromise was a four-letter word. I didn't think so. And there were times that I would, you know, stick my stake in the ground and not, because it was too important. And it also made an important statement to set the spectrum in a way that I thought was important. But I also wasn't afraid of compromise. What is so beautiful, I think, about the potential for ranked choice voting is that we are there to find consensus. So I may go in with loving Bernie, or I may go in loving Joe or loving Elizabeth Warren. But in the end, if more people, we can find consensus on a second choice, it's not going to kill me. It's not going to kill me. It's going to actually make me feel like I have found common ground with my neighbor.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's like one of the things that people say to defend the caucuses is that, you know, you have to campaign not just for your candidate, but you have to reach out to your neighbor who might like this and be nice to them and make a good pitch to them, because it might be that you're trying to convince them to come over to your side, right? So it changes the nature and the tenor of campaigning in a way that I think most people think is very positive. And I think you don't have to have this convoluted caucus system to get that same type of result, right?
Exactly.
Ranked choice voting solves that as well.
Exactly.
Right? You will be campaigning for your candidate, and when you come across someone who has a different first choice than you, you're not going to scream at them about how they're wrong. You're going to have a conversation about them, about your candidate, and why you think, like, your candidate should be their second choice, right?
Well, like, absolutely.
We get that same result with ranked choice voting.
So in a lot of ways, I think, you know, at a national level, I'm gonna task you with this, Sean. We have to talk about gerrymandering as something that divides us. We have to talk about how the vote is dividing us, but that ranked choice would thread us together. We have to start talking about money and politics. We have to start talking about the Electoral College. What we see is what Donald Trump has done is massage the divide. What we're seeing happening with the Democratic Party is that we're actually massaging the divide. What we need to do more than anything is to restore trust, if there ever was trust, but figure out a way to bring us back together. And we turn out to institutionally divide us through even how we freaking vote. And that to me, and I understand votes are about choices, but they aren't about stark choices. Nothing is black or white. Everything is kind of a shade. I mean, even, you know, we are a country of others. And if we're a country of others, then we need to have respect for others. And that doesn't mean that they're better than us or right. It means that we can find some common ground. And I think if we can start talking about ranked choice voting and gerrymandering and money and politics and thread them together and point to the Democratic Party's fighting and point to what Donald Trump is doing, I think you can begin to see this is how we heal.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, like, we coming out of this disaster, I think another important point here is Iowa and New Hampshire are both incredibly small states, right? Yeah. When it comes down to the realities of actually impacting the choice of who our nominee is, we actually don't have much of an influence. The full impact of our influence is just because we're first. And because we're first, a national media who has been chomping at the bit to do horse race journalism for a year kind of seizes on this and creates a media narrative. The thing that all of these campaigns are paying hundreds of millions of dollars for and deploying thousands of staff for. They're doing it for that media narrative, right? And that media narrative, you know, in Iowa, it wasn't delivered on time, and now it's completely irrelevant. It's not like the delegates that come out of Iowa are going to tip the nomination one way or the other.
Yep.
So, you know, this is an opportunity to take a step back and just look and be like, what are we doing? In this process of choosing a nominee? And, like, can we do it better? Can we just start from, you know, the drawing board, start fresh and think about a system that makes sense? Because the thing that we've been clinging to from top to bottom just doesn't make any sense. And if there's any silver lining to come out of this, reporting debacle, it's just taking that fresh view and analysis and evaluating, like, why do we do it this way? And what are the other ways that we could do this better?
So I hate to say this, but I was supposed to do a bunch of national media as a result of what happened after Iowa. Actually, I was booked 2 weeks ago. They've been pulling me off of all the national media. And I suspect that my Democratic Party wants me off. Why? Because I'm going to say exactly what you said. I'm going to say that about the New Hampshire primary. And they, of course, want to protect it. They want to covet it. They don't want anyone to think there's anything wrong with it. And I am going to repeat what you said. And then all of a sudden, ABC News goes, oh, we don't need you Friday night. MSNBC says, oh, we don't need you tonight. So I'm just telling you, here they booked me 2 weeks ago, and all of a sudden they've heard me say this in other media venues, and now all those national media sites are now asking me not to show up. So in a lot of ways, you are right. I suspect I am right, but being right means being very alone. Ask Mitt Romney. And on that note, Sean Sebastian, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. And at some point in time, we're going to have to do this kumbaya and tell the rest of the country, it's okay. You can live without us being first. It'll work. It'll work. Yeah. All right. Take care. Ciao. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We first had Texas, then we went to Iowa. Don't you love this show? See you next week. You better think.